something very definite, the limit. Thus, it has greater significance than all the real magnitudes by which it is bounded. That summer of 1966, the year Zhu Li died, was the zero point for my father. Like hundreds of thousands of others, he went to Tiananmen Square to pledge his loyalty to Chairman Mao and commit himself to Fanshen, literally, to turn over one's body, to liberate oneself. Decades later, he watched on television as three university students stood before the Great Hall of the People bearing a letter to the government. It was April 22, 1989. The three lifted their arms, raised the petition high, and fell to their knees, as if seeking clemency. Behind them, in Tiananmen Square, more than 200,000 university students reacted in shock and then grief. "Why are you kneeling? Stand up, stand up. This is the People's Square. Why must we address the government from our knees? How can you kneel in our name? How?" The students, who came from every political and economic background, were distraught. But the three stayed where they were, tiny figures, the petition heavy in the air, waiting for an authority figure to receive it. 10, 20, 30 minutes passed, and they remained on their knees. Behind them, agitation grew. When Chinese leaders failed to respond, the Tiananmen demonstrations began in earnest. I exited the subway at Tiantong Road, emerging at an intersection where condominiums, half-constructed, opened like giant staircases to the sky. I had been to this quarter before. Hongkou is where Swirl and Big Mother Knife grew up before the war, and it is where Liu Feng, a violinist once known as Tofu Liu, now lives. At different times, Hongkou has been a clothing district, the American-Japanese concession, and, during the rise of Hitler and the Second World War, the Shanghai ghetto. In the 1930s, the Shanghai port could be legally entered without passport or visa. Some 40,000 Jewish and other refugees from Germany, Austria, Russia, Iraq, India, Lithuania, Poland, and Ukraine, and elsewhere arrived here, bringing not only their languages and traumas, but also their music. I continued south, past a sidewalk argument, around three men, their bodies fully stretched out on their motorbikes, playing cards. At Suzhou Creek, I reached the embankment building. Up on the 10th floor, Mr. Liu was waiting for me. I had contacted him on WeChat, and, at first, when I said I was the daughter of Zhang Kai, he had been wary. But when I told him I was looking for Ai Ming, the daughter of Sparrow, he transformed entirely. Now, the first time we were meeting in person, he greeted me as if he had known me all my life. "Ma Li," he said. "Come in, come in. Have you eaten? My daughter picked up these sugar pyramids." Books, sheet music, compact discs, cassettes and records occupied every inch of space. After a 30-year teaching career at Shanghai Conservatory, he had retired last month and moved his office home.
"Don't trip," he said. "I don't have insurance."
We went sideways through the kitchen and into the living room. Across the river, Shanghai's dramatic skyscrapers floated, surreal. We were a world away, but only a single generation from the city my father had known. Mr. Liu told me that since the 1990s, he had watched this skyline come into existence.
"When my daughter was born, none of these buildings were even a scribble on paper. These three, he said, pointing out the tallest ones, were meant to symbolize the past, present, and future. But the government's words were very boring. Instead, people called them the three-piece kitchen set. You see? There's the bottle opener, the whisk, and, what would you say in English? A turkey baster?
I laughed. I think the whisk is the most beautiful, Mr. Liu. It was a cylindrical spiral, like a ribbon in motion.
I agree, but Shanghai still looks like a tool belt. By the way, don't be so formal. Please call me Tofu Liu. That's what everyone calls me, even my grandkids.
Before us, the lights of the buildings began to glow. Tofu Liu turned his back on the city. We sat down at a little table where someone had been sorting pencil crayons. He told me that he had entered the Shanghai Conservatory the same year as Su Li.
We both studied under the same violin teacher, Tan Hong. My father was a convicted rightist, a counter-revolutionary, just like Zhu Li's father. I was a little in love with her, even while I envied her talent.
During the Cultural Revolution, the conservatory had closed.
Not one piano survived.
Not one.
He himself was sent to a camp in Heilongjiang province, in the frozen borderlands of the northeast.
We had to wear either blue, gray, or black. Our hair had to be short. We had to wear the same kind of cap. That was only the beginning. The wind was glacial. We were beside a river, and on the other side of the river was Russia. We worked in coal mines. We had no skills in this work, and almost every week someone was seriously injured or killed. The party replaced them. The only books available to us were the writings of Chairman Mao. We had daily self-criticism and denunciation sessions. This went on for 6 years.
In 1977, when the Cultural Revolution ended, Liu ran away from the camp and returned to Shanghai, where he sought out his former teacher, Tan Hong.
We talked about Zhu Li for a long time, and about others we had known.
Then Professor Tan asked me,
Tofu Liu, do you wish to come back to the conservatory and complete your studies? I said I did.
After everything that's happened, why?
His question devastated me. How could I pretend that music was salvation? How could I commit myself to something so powerless? I had been a miner for 6 years. There was coal dust in my lungs. I'd broken all the fingers of my right hand. How could I possibly hold a violin? I told him I don't know, but he kept pushing me for an answer. It wasn't enough for him to hear that I loved music, that it had comforted me all this time. And I had promised myself that if I survived, I would devote my life to it. There were thousands of applicants for a handful of spots at the conservatory. They all loved music as much as I did. Finally, I told him the truth. I said, because music is nothing. It is nothing, and yet it belongs to me. Despite everything that's happened, it's myself that I believe in. Tan Hong shook my hand. He said, Yang Liu, welcome back to the conservatory. Welcome home.
Tofu Liu showed me his mementos. These included a photo of Zhu Li performing with the conservatory string quartet when she was 9 years old, and a wire recording of Zhu Li and Kai playing Smetana's From My Homeland, which Liu had kept hidden until the end of the Cultural Revolution. But, Mr. Liu, how could you possibly hide these things? He shrugged, smiling.
Before I was sent to the Russian border, I cut a small hole in the parquet floor of my bedroom in Shanghai. You know how hard parquet is. All I had was a kitchen knife. It took me 2 terrible weeks. I was convinced that Red Guards would burst into the room, and that would be the end of me. I buried 12 wire recordings, some photos and scores, and my violin. 10 years later, when I pulled it up, there was a nest of mice inside the violin. But look at this wire.
He lifted the spool and showed it to me. It was pristine.
Would you like to hear it?
I nodded, unable to speak. Delicately, he loaded the spool into an antique wire recorder. When it was ready, he turned a knob. The notes came to me. I half turned away. I thought I saw curtains shift, and Ba looking down at me from a window above. On the 9th floor, he leaned out. Did anyone else see him? Was it only me? My father had blindfolded himself. He had tied a piece of cloth over his face before he took his life. I had learned this only after obtaining copies of the Hong Kong police files, and the detail had broken me. This was the first time I had ever heard Ba playing the piano. Jiang Kai seemed a stranger to me, someone who had always been more alive, more full of memory than I could know. And yet, hearing Zhu Li's violin, her measured, open voice, why did I feel as if I had known her all my life? We listened to the recording 3, 4, 5 times. Each time I heard something different, a separation and a unity. The musicians, dust, the machine, our breathing. Music. Each time at the end I heard my father's voice speaking. I had not heard it since I was 10 years old. His voice, like no other voice that had ever lived. I wept. Seeing that I was upset, Mr. Liu brought me a cup of tea.
"It's difficult to understand," he said. "The pressure on us was unimaginable. Don't forget, back then your father was only 17 years old. We were all too young."
We returned to the table. I showed him my copy of Chapter 17 of the Book of Records. "Teacher Liu," I said, "I've made tens of thousands of copies of all the notebooks. With a few keystrokes, it's possible to send files anywhere in the world, instantaneously. I want it to exist everywhere, to keep growing and changing." From my bag, I took out Sparrow's composition, "The Sun Shines on the People's Square." This is the piece of music I mentioned to you. It seems only right to perform it here in Shanghai, to record it. But I really wonder at my sanity. Liu took the pages. Slowly he read through them. I watched the curtains move and the wind alter. Ba and Ma had left this world. Yet I was here in Shanghai. I still breathed and changed and dreamed. After a long time, Liu looked up from the score.
"Ma Li," he said, "I'm sure you know that without obsession, there is no life's work. But where does this attentiveness come from? Have you asked yourself? Surely it's what we each carry, in greater and greater quantity as we age. Remembrance. He used the word 记忆, which has two meanings. 记忆, to recall, record, and 记忆, art. He was silent for a moment, looking down at the pages.
The music reminds me of something Zhu Li said when we were rehearsing Prokofiev. She said the music made her wonder. Does it alter us more to be heard or to hear? Is it better to have been loved or to love? Of all his compositions, this is Teacher Sparrow's most extraordinary.
He opened his violin case and lifted the instrument out. A phrase filled the room. It seemed to move both backwards and forwards, as if Sparrow wished to rewrite time itself. Note by note, I felt as if I was being reconfigured. Then Teacher Liu set the violin down. He asked me, "Do you play the piano?" I never learned.
"Then I'll arrange everything. Teacher Sparrow meant for this music to be heard here."
"Thank you, Professor." Before I left, I showed him a photograph of Ai Ming.
"Why, it's Zhu Li, isn't it?"
he said in surprise, staring at the image.
"It must be. No, it's Teacher Sparrow's daughter, Ai Ming."
"Ah, well, how remarkable. She has the very same face as Miss Zhu Li." Tofu Liu gave me the recording to keep, and I gave him a copy of Sparrow's music. I remembered, then, something that Ai Ming had said. I assumed that when the story finished, life would continue and I would go back to being myself. But it wasn't true. The stories got longer and longer, and I got smaller and smaller. When I told Big Mother this, she laughed her head off. But that's how the world is, isn't it?
Chapter 6 Sparrow was pedaling slowly home from Huizhou Wooden Crate Factory, pushed forward by a steady breeze. It was late August, just after rainfall. Along the road, loudspeakers announced a special program. Tonight in Beijing, the Philadelphia Orchestra, under Eugene Ormandy, will perform for Madame Mao. This is their third concert in the city, one of a total of 6 performances in China. The newsreader had said the date, September 14th, 1973. But it was 1976. The concert had been almost 3 years before. Others, too, were staring up at the loudspeakers just as baffled. It had been nearly a decade since the radio had broadcast any music, besides the 18 approved revolutionary operas. Now, music exploded above them, the feverish opening crescendo of Respighi's Pines of Rome. Sparrow coasted to a stop, bewildered by its detail, the cheerful, almost absurd piano, and the tinkling brass. By the time he reached home, the second half of the program had begun. His daughter ran out to meet him.
"It's new work by Madame Mao."
Sparrow smiled, despite himself.
"No, Ai Ming, this is Beethoven, and it comes from another century."
This is a fragment, he thought, of something that once existed, but that no longer grows here, like a field cut down. He went inside. The 6th Symphony, Beethoven's Pastoral, trotted gaily through the rooms. Even Big Mother was lost in thought. He thought the walls were creeping nearer to him, They brushed his arms and scraped the back of his neck. You could close a book and forget about it, knowing it would not lose its contents when you stopped reading. But music wasn't the same. Not for him. It was most alive when it was heard. Year after year, he wanted to play and replay it, to take it apart into its component pieces and build it once more. And then, finally, after 6 years, after 7, and then a decade, his memory had gone quiet. Without trying, he had stopped remembering. But this broadcast, what was it? Were they hearing the future, or was it only the final outburst of the past? Long ago, He Luting had shouted, "Shame, shame, you should be ashamed." And Zhu Li said, "I will make Prokofiev himself proud." If the concert truly took place in Beijing, Kai must have attended. A sound inside a sound. But what if all of this was only in his mind? The applause that came was so fierce he feared the radio might topple over. Violent catapults of applause, rhythmic, sustained. From the opposite side of the room, Big Mother said, "What bloody change is coming now?" The music was nothing more than a broadcast, a simple program. But he turned and saw exultation on his daughter's face. Little Ai Ming had pressed her forehead up against the radio. His daughter was overjoyed. She had been transported. She looked as if all her nerves were alight. She looked like Zhu Li. For a moment, he had no idea where he was. He wanted to pull her back, to take the machine away and bury it noiselessly in the ground. Trembling with cold, he walked across the room and switched the radio off. Because her father was so quiet, Ai Ming had, from an early age, turned to Big Mother Knife. Her grandmother was her confidant, her teacher, and also her pillow. No one in this life cared about her as Big Mother did, and so she took great pleasure in climbing over her, sleeping on her, and fluffing Big Mother's curls. Ling, her actual mother, had been reassigned to Shanghai nearly 5 years ago, and only visited once each year, during Spring Festival. Her father, Sparrow, was the bird of quiet. "Don't be fooled," Big Mother once told her. "He's not moving as usual, and he's not thinking either, sadly. Your father is empty as a walnut shell." She had leaned close and whispered in Ai Ming's ear, "The world is like a banana, easily bruised. Now is the time to watch and observe, not to judge. Ai Ming, believing everything in books is worse than having no books at all." For weeks after, Ai Ming wondered about these words. On the August night, when the Philadelphia Orchestra performance was broadcast, she had spied on her father as he listened to this Beethoven, and she observed how, for at least a year afterwards, the radio returned to its usual music, playing only Sha Jia Bang and Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy. Once, though, there had been a broadcast of Albanian music, and it had made Sparrow stop what he was doing and turn towards the radio, as if it were an intruder. In school, as the daughter of a class enemy, she was forbidden to join the young pioneers, among other injustices. This was a new word for her, injustice, and she liked to roll it on her tongue for the shock of it. In school, they recited essays about what made a good revolutionary. She began to wonder what made a good father, a good grandmother, a good enemy, a good person. "Are you a good person?" she thought, looking at her teacher. "Or are you a good revolutionary? Are you a good revolutionary, she thought, looking at Big Mother Knife, or are you a good grandmother? Was it even possible to be both? The game intrigued her. How pleasurable it was to bury words inside the soil of her thoughts. She imitated her father's expression, a studied emptiness. But sometimes his expression failed him. Sometimes Sparrow looked at her with so much anxiety, she felt her hair stand on end. Bah, she thought, are you a good person or a good worker? Is Chairman Mao a good person or a good leader? One morning, Big Mother unlocked the battered suitcase that was used primarily as their dining table. Inside the trunk was a single straw shoe, a pretty blue dress, a sheaf of music in Jianpu notation, and a cardboard box full of notebooks. Her first observation was that the books were grubby. "Your mouth is hanging open," Big Mother said. Her grandmother fanned the notebooks out, removed three, and told Aiming to close the suitcase. When it was latched and locked, Big Mother set the notebooks down and opened the first one. The pages looked even older than her grandmother. Big Mother's face swooped down as if to taste the paper. From this position, she turned her head and looked at Aiming. "This," she whispered gruffly, "is what excellent calligraphy looks like." Aiming went in for a closer look. The characters seemed to hover just above the paper, like ink over water. They had the pristine cleanliness of winter flowers.
"Hua, isn't it strong?" Big Mother said.
Delight squeezed Aiming's heart.
"Hua,"
she whispered. Big Mother straightened, grunting her approval.
"Of course, the calligraphy is not as robust as Chairman Mao's, but still, it's pretty good. Refined, yet with a depth of movement. Maybe you want to read some to me? Chapter 1, but no more. You're still far too young."
It was early morning. Her father was at the factory, which, last year, had been reborn. Now it was Huizhou Semiconductor Factory Number 1. And he had gone from building wooden crates to making radios. The Bird of Quiet could assemble the new Red Lamp 711 shortwave radio in the shake of a feather. Outside, loudspeakers were chiding the world. Rain fell in continuous sheets, beating the tin roof like a regiment of horses. So they hid under the blankets. The many wrinkles on Big Mother's face reminded Aiming of the dry, patient earth in February, thirsty for spring. How can you ignore this sharp awl that pierces your heart? If you yearn for things outside yourself, you will never obtain what you are seeking. And so the novel of Da Wei and May 4th began once more. It pleased Big Mother Knife that Aiming did not appear to notice the transition from the original Book of Records to the new chapters written by Wen the Dreamer. Unable to recover the rest of the book, he had simply continued on from Chapter 31. He, like the character of May 4th, would spend the greater part of his life in the deserts of Gansu, Xinjiang, and Kyrgyzstan, where, they said, more than 300 ancient settlements lay beneath the sand. Their traces, documents on wood and paper, silks and household objects, had endured, preserved by the dry air. In the new chapters, Wen continued the old code, hiding their whereabouts inside the names of characters. Sometimes the code was descriptive. Wei, the bright shining of the sun. Wei, a fine rain. Or Wei, a cove or a bend in the hills. Sometimes heartbreaking,
Wei, not, or Wei, to flow backwards. Throughout her childhood, little Ai Ming asked for chapter 23 to be reread so many times the words must have shown up in her dreams. What the child pictured or how she made sense of it, Big Mother could not say. "This literary resurrection of yours," she wrote to Wen the dreamer, "has won another admirer." She meant Ai Ming, but Wen the dreamer imagined Zhu Li, not grown. It was 1976, and Zhu Li would have been 25 years old. Big Mother had begun letter after letter, telling Swirl that her daughter was gone. But she did not have the courage to send a single one. In September of that year, she wrote that Zhu Li had received permission to study in the Paris Conservatory. Their beloved child had crossed over into the West. Big Mother half believed her own letters. It was the first time since the start of the great proletarian cultural revolution that such a lie was even remotely credible. "My beloved Swirl," she thought, "I fear you will never forgive me." She sealed the letter and entrusted it to their messenger, projectionist Bang, who traveled the hinterlands showing movies in the villages and was a trusted confidant of Wen the Dreamer. That same September, the end of the beginning came. In the morning, loudspeakers cried out the same turbulent song. "The esteemed and great leader of our party, our army, and the people, Comrade Mao Zedong, leader of the international proletariat, has died." Big Mother walked the shrouded streets. She stood before the newspaper boards and squinted at the text. Squinting made no difference. These were yesterday's papers. She thought of her sister and Wen, of her lost boys and Ba Lut, the unwritten music, the desperate lives, the bitter untruths they had told themselves and passed on to their children, how every day of Sparrow's factory life was filled with humiliations. Party cadres withheld his rations, demanded self-criticisms, scorned the way he held his head, his pencil, his hands, his silence. And her son had no choice but to accept it all. He let them pour all their words into him, as if the life inside him had burned away, as if his own two hands had knotted the rope around Zhu Li. Yet Big Mother thought she understood. In this country, rage had no place to exist except deep inside, turned against oneself. This is what had become of her son. He had used his anger to tear himself apart. Yes, how simple a thing it was to weep, she thought, gazing out at the frenzy of grief and uncertainty around her. She tried not to think of Da Shan and Flying Bear, of Zhu Li, of all the names that would disappear completely, relegated to history so as not to disturb the living. White paper flowers, the traditional symbol of mourning, inundated every tree. She wept with rage and helplessness at all the crimes for which the death of an old, treacherous man could never answer. Ai Ming was 6 years old and had never seen a foreigner before, but she thought the tall Chinese man with the shiny shoes and the pristine shirt with buttons must be from another province, if not from another age, perhaps the future. He had wavy hair, immaculate eyebrows, round eyes, a clean-shaven face, and in his pocket, bright as sunlight, a golden pen. She had not known initially that there was a stranger in the house. When the music began to play, she had turned as if in a dream and rushed towards it. Looking through the open door was like peering into a cave. They were facing her, new shirt and her father, but they were so busy looking at something that she snuck inside and melted against the wall. If her father didn't know she was there, how could he make her go away? As her eyes grew accustomed to the darkness, the two men sharpened. New Shirt was clearly listening to the music, but Ba looked all chewed up. His elbows and knees contorted. He was folded up as if to protect his hands. Music held them within its downpour. Ai Ming squeezed her eyes shut and popped them open again. No, they were still there. Her father stared at nothing. The music, a joyful dance, made her think of the poem, famous pieces and grand words, and of the carcasses of dead radios Sparrow sometimes carried home, tinkering with them in his spare time. Now the music coiled into another feeling. It seemed to start all over again, but suddenly it ended. New Shirt reached out to a square box that had a big whisker. He lifted a circle from the square, so shiny black it was almost blue, and he turned the circle upside down. He flicked a switch and pushed the whisker down. Her father said, "No, it's enough. Don't play the second side." Another switch was turned. Ai Ming felt as if the remains of the music were treading silently from the room. Through the doorway, the light sagged in pinkish gray. "Kai, your performance tomorrow. What time will it be?" Even Ba's words sounded smaller. "You must come." Kai reached into the pocket that held his golden pen. He retrieved a square of paper and gave it to her father. "It's in the factory buildings. We're doing Beethoven's Emperor, Dvorak's Symphony No. 9, and an American composer." He said so many foreign words, Ai Ming wanted to cry out at the strangeness of it. "Li Dolun is conducting." Her father held the paper and stared at it as if he could not read. "All through the Cultural Revolution, we were able to perform," Kai said. "Saiji Ozawa visited the Central Philharmonic last year. Did you know he was born in Manchuria? Not everything disappeared. It was only put aside." "What happened to He Luting? The last time I saw him was on television, years ago now. 1968?
"I heard it was Chairman Mao himself who ordered He Luting released from prison."
The man's voice was smooth, like unmarked paper.
"A few years ago, the charges were dropped, and his name cleared."
Kai picked up a square of cardboard and looked into its image.
"These recordings are so rare now, Sparrow."
"Last October, people in Beijing began to unearth the records they had hidden. After Madame Mao was arrested, we thought everything would go back to the way it was, but people know the Cultural Revolution is finally over. It was all the work of Madame Mao, the Gang of Four, and so on. That's what the government says, but they can't help being cautious. Not many records have resurfaced. I did meet a professor at Beijing University who has a small treasure of scores, but that's all. Isaac Stern will visit Beijing and Shanghai. Have you heard? Next year."
Sparrow said nothing. Kai adjusted his long legs and continued.
"When Ozawa came, he said our ability to interpret the music had fundamentally changed."
He extended his hand as if he were carrying two eggs.
"As if an entire emotional range was lost to us. But we ourselves couldn't hear it. Every musician in the orchestra knew they'd been cheated. But until that moment, we never had to face it so directly."
"Maybe some people always knew," Sparrow said. "Maybe they never stopped knowing what was counterfeit."
Kai brushed his fingers against his own mouth
as if to rid himself of dust. Now Sparrow addressed the other man as if he were a student or a younger brother.
Now that things are changing, what will you do, comrade? Do you still hope to study in the West?
Sparrow, please don't misunderstand. Her father shifted his cotton pants, pulling them up slightly, as if he was sitting outside and the sun warming his ankles.
We've started auditions at the Shanghai Conservatory, Kai said. There are over 1,000 applicants for a handful of spots. He Luting will be reinstated as president. The old faculty will be invited back. Your father, too. And you.
He Luting specifically asked me to visit you.
My father is in Anhui province. I'll write down the name of the labor camp for you.
Sparrow, some of the applications are from your former students. Remember old Wu? They don't forget. Some of them thought they might never touch a violin or piano again.
They spoke of names and places Aiming didn't know. In fact, she had never heard her father string together so many sentences in a row. It was as if the bird of quiet had taken off a coat of feathers, or put one on and become another creature. Outside, her grandmother was calling for her, but Aiming burrowed even further into the shadows. Eventually, Big Mother shouted something about eating frozen pineapple on a stick, and creaked away.
But Shostakovich died.
When?
2 years ago.
Li Delun managed to get hold of his last symphony, which none of us had heard. And Symphony No. 4, which he withdrew, remember? And a series of string quartets.
Where are your brothers?
In the northwest. Flying Bear is in Tibet. Dashan joined the People's Liberation Army.
Do they come to see you?
No, they don't have permission.
Kai said, these reforms will give us back what was taken.
I honestly believe this. You must have faith, Sparrow.
There was more music. As they listened, Sparrow and the man sat so close together, they made a single confused shape.
Sparrow, I've been thinking about Julie.
I can't. Tell me instead, what record is this?
This? Don't you remember? It's Tchaikovsky's transcription of Bach, the chorale preludes. For every vital movement in the world around us, there is a corresponding movement within us, a feeling.
They used foreign words to describe the sound, which made her feel as if the night sky had been slipped into her pocket.
Since the reform and opening up, I've tried to. It's very difficult. I can't stop thinking about her. About Julie. Do you find that strange?
No, Sparrow. But no one is responsible for what happened.
That isn't true.
Come back and teach at the conservatory. You'll be able to write again, to continue where you left off. What happened to your symphonies?
Her father laughed, and the sound chilled her.
My symphonies.
Aiming must have slept, because when she opened her eyes again, Kai was gone. It was only Sparrow sitting in front of the square box, leaning towards it, as if to another, more beloved child. When Big Mother lit the lamp and found her curled up on the floor, she gave Aiming the needle eye.
I was listening to music, Aiming said, and I had a stomach ache.
She smiled, because her own words sounded preposterous. Who gave you permission to have a stomach anything?
The bird of quiet paid no attention.
Early the next morning, she found him sitting outside, smoking peacefully, oblivious to the breakfast Big Mother had prepared. One by one, Aiming ate all his spicy cucumbers. The bird of quiet was a shy creature. One had to approach him softly, as if he were a goat.
"Who built that singing box?"
she whispered. He started. She feared that everything she did unsettled him, and it made her so mad she wanted to shout at him and slap herself. Sparrow said it wasn't a singing box. It was an electric singing engine, a record player.
"I want to see it."
He brought out the box once more. When he lifted and let go of its sturdy whisker, she could not tell if her father was bothered or tired, or only lost. The piece of music with the slow, spare notes turned out to be Variation Number 25 of Bach's Goldberg Variations. She told her father that hearing the music was like looking into a radio. What she meant was that even looking at the innards of the sets her father brought home, even staring into the belly of the machine, into the thing itself, electricity and sound remained as exquisitely mysterious as the night sky. He looked at her with such sadness, as if she were someone else entirely. He taught her the first foreign names she ever learned. The first,
Bach,
Bach, and the second,
Gurda,
Glenn Gould. Inside Sparrow, sounds accumulated, bells, birds, and the uneven cracking of the trees, loud and quiet insects, songs that spilled from people, even if they never intended to make a noise. He suspected he was doing the same. Was he, unconsciously, humming a folk song or a Bach partita? Had he done it when he walked with Aiming at night, hoping to turn her eyes to something larger?
The hiss of small soldering devices crackled in his ears.
The same tired jokes, the same clanking and capacitors, resistors and minuscule shunts. The high-pitched pain in his hands, the sly meetings and self-criticism sessions, the repeated slogans like a knife sharpening to dullness. Sound was alive and disturbing and outside of any individual's control. Sound had a freedom that no thought could equal, because a sound made no absolute claim on meaning. Any word, on the other hand, could be forced to signify its opposite. One night he dreamed that he sat in a concert hall. Around him programs fluttered, voices hummed, bags opened and closed, the orchestra keened towards harmony. Giddy with joy, full of nervous anticipation, he awaited the performance of his own symphony number 3. A chime summoned the last members of the audience. The lights dimmed. Quiet settled. He watched, unable to move, as Zhu Li walked onto the stage in a long blue dress. She searched the auditorium for him. Her hands were empty. He woke. In the cultural palace of the people, on the grounds of the Huizhou battery factory, Sparrow presented his ticket, expecting to be turned away. Instead, he was shown to a row of reserved seats. Everywhere was movement. Upwards of 1,000 people pressed into the hall. Party cadres, gray. Office workers, white. Assembly line workers, blue. Filing beneath a cascading banner that read, "Fully expose and condemn the treason committed by the Gang of Four." Sparrow found his seat. Beside him, a woman in her mid-20s, dressed in a pale green skirt and a flowering blouse, was turning heads. A few months ago, the flowered blouse would have been deemed unacceptable, even criminal. But today, it was merely odd. The young woman, confusingly familiar, wore her hair loose. Unbraided, it curled in arabesques. There was a mark on the underside of her chin, the shape of a thumb, a violinist's mark. She turned and met his gaze. Sparrow blinked, embarrassed to be caught staring. He turned back to the stage. Eventually, the conductor of the Central Philharmonic, Li Delun, stepped forward. From the podium, Li stared out with a quivering calm. The two pens in his breast pocket shone extravagantly. Li introduced the concert program. Mahler, Beethoven, and Copland. And then began speaking, at length, about the successor to Chairman Mao, Deng Xiaoping. It was extraordinary that Deng had come to power. He, too, had been brought down by the Cultural Revolution, his political career destroyed, and his family targeted. His eldest son had been tortured by Red Guards and, in 1966, fell, or was pushed, out a third-story window, the same as San Li. But father and son had outlasted the turmoil. The son now famous in his wheelchair. Deng had outmaneuvered Madame Mao and her admirers, who now languished in prison. Now, with the backing of the Politburo, he was unrolling a series of economic and political reforms. In the auditorium, Li's speech was a kind of song in itself, in which people intermittently cried out, "Ashes burn once more," and "Strive to implement the four modernizations of Comrade Deng." The great helmsman's name, Xiaoping, meant little bottle. And so, in the trees just outside, someone had hung a collection of small green bottles, along with colorful banners that read, "Deng Blue Skies." The glass tinkled in the breeze, a hope for better days. Facing waves of applause, Li cried out, "Let us build a just society, a revolutionary China fit for a musical people." Beside Sparrow, the young woman sighed, as if wishing to propel herself onto the stage where the musicians were now filing out in solemn rows. The Central Philharmonic wore their everyday clothing, gray or blue slacks, and short-sleeved button-down shirts. Sparrow's heart was beating so oddly. He felt it was detaching from his body. The sound of the orchestra tuning chilled him. Strings, woodwinds, and brass made their simultaneous climb or descent to a sustained A, and an oboe fluttered up the scale like a thought set loose. Sparrow had not seen a score since 1968, and the ones used by the Philharmonic appeared to be hand-copied. The music stands, too, were makeshift, held together by tape, string, and wooden splints. He felt the clattering tap of Li Dulun's baton on the music stand as if the conductor had rapped on Sparrow's own spine. Mahler's Ninth Symphony rose in a tentative hum. The house lights had remained up, and every face in the audience, every small reaction, was visible. No one fidgeted. On stage, the musicians leaned forward, as if they were sliding across the same tilting boat. A bright red banner gave way at one corner. "Premier Zhou Enlai lives forever in our hearts." It folded diagonally, but didn't fall. Danger seemed to come from every side. The young woman's hands were covering her face, and he wanted desperately to take them and place them in her lap. "You must not let them see," he thought. "If they see that you are devoted to it, they will take it from you." The reverie of the first movement sharpened to a hallucinatory edge. Sparrow silenced the music by thinking about Mahler himself. Late in life, the composer had discovered, in German translation, the poets Li Bai and Wang Wei, and their poetry had provided the text for Mahler's song symphony, Das Lied von der Erde, The Song of the Earth. The poems had been translated into French, and then into German, and from there Mahler had made his own editions, so that the poems, copies of mistranslated copies, were almost untraceable to their beginnings. But some were known, including Wang Wei's Farewell, familiar to everyone of his and his mother's generation, even if they no longer recited the lines. At Odds with the World, Returned to Rest by the South Hill. Over the next hour, Sparrow succeeded in pushing away the sound of the orchestra. It was warm in the hall, and his shirt was damp, the damp hardening to an icy cold. There was no intermission. As the piano was being wheeled out for Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, Li Delun came to the microphone again. "We dedicate this Concerto No. 5 to our resurrected comrade, He Luting, President of the Shanghai Conservatory," he said. "Long live Chairman Deng! Long live the Communist Party of China! Long live our country!" In the hall, surprised and consternation, but also sustained applause, and even, Sparrow thought, cautious jubilation. Amidst the noise, Kai came forward and took his seat at the piano. It was small, the kind a well-to-do family might have kept in their home before the Cultural Revolution. It was the first piano Sparrow had seen since 1966. Kai sat with his back rigidly straight. He had no score in front of him. Sparrow could see where his trousers, cuffed unevenly, lifted to expose his ankles. The pianist waited, both hands on his thighs, as the concerto opened in controlled exclamations, vibrating across the auditorium. Kai began, traversing the scales with a familiar clarity, only the tips of his body, head, fingers, and feet moving. Inside Sparrow's head, multiple versions played. He simultaneously saw the performance and heard a memory, a recording. He listened to the immense space between then and now. When the allegro began, Sparrow closed his eyes. Up and down the scales again, as if Kai were telling him there is no way out, there is only the path back again. And even when we think we're free, we only endlessly return. The concerto's beauty was even more impassioned than he remembered, and also more piteous and quiet and restrained, and he clasped his hands together to absorb both the grief and joy in his body. He remembered long ago playing Flying Bear's violin for Zhu Li. Beside him, the young woman's eyes were glassy with tears that did not fall. Sparrow could not imagine weeping openly. He inhaled and found himself, against his will, listening. Near the end of the movement, the first jubilant chords repeated, but the notes no longer conveyed the original feeling. Underneath was an ending, a buried movement, the sound of one life held captive by another. The concerto swept on, never pausing to dwell on its own astonishing constructions. On stage, the first violinist played with his whole body, and then suddenly, as if remembering the audience, he closed up again. Sparrow tried to place Zhu Li before him. Beneath the violin, her supporting arm had always appeared so pale. He remembered her humility before the music. Even as a child, she had felt accountable to it. The notes went on, as if living another life. He could have followed Kai to Beijing, but he had never known how to write music, to perform music, and yet be silent. Tumultuous applause swept over him. Kai stood. All the musicians stood, their white shirts damp with sweat,
feathery against their bodies. The encores came. Sparrow saw the young woman staring straight ahead, and he recognized in her an ambition, a desire that he was certain he no longer possessed.